This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A few hours ago, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice flew out of Islamabad, where she offered support and condolences to the people and government of Pakistan. While there, she reiterated the U.S. pledge of $50 million to help the country recover from Saturday's devastating earthquake. 5 days on, help is finally reaching survivors in many isolated mountain towns. Today, as skies cleared, helicopters were able to ferry in much-needed supplies, like tents, medicine, and food, to some of the estimated 2 million people who've been left homeless. Entire towns were knocked to rubble, roads and tunnels blocked, electricity and phone lines obliterated. Then, over the past few days, rain and hail added to the misery. Today we'll focus on the organization and logistics of international relief efforts. How many tents? What kind of medicine and food? Who decides? And who pays for it? In a moment, we'll talk with the leader of the U.S. Disaster Assistance Response Team in Pakistan and also with the Emergency Coordinator for Doctors Without Borders. Later in the program, we'll continue our series on Iraq's constitutional referendum and visit the largely Shia city of Basra. But first, marshaling disaster relief. If you have questions about how the experts respond to disaster, what they do when they hit the ground, how they help people who've lost everything, or if you've been involved in organizing such an effort, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our first guest is an old hand with natural disaster. Bill Berger is the leader of the U.S. DART team in Pakistan. The acronym stands for Disaster Assistance Response Team. When he's not out in the field, he lives in Kathmandu, Nepal, where he's the regional advisor to the U.S. Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. And he joins us now by phone from his hotel in Islamabad. And thanks for staying up for us. We appreciate your time.
Glad to do it, Neil.
When did you first get a phone call about this earthquake, and who was it who called you?
Well, we're notified by the USGS anytime there's an earthquake around the world.
So the U.S. Geological Service. The U.S. Geological Survey. Yeah. And so
they send out an alert to all of our teams. And that's when I first found out the news, and I immediately started calling Washington and our embassy in Pakistan to get more information.
When you say you started calling Washington, the USGS or the State Department, the Pentagon, who?
It's OFDA in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
We monitor these things, and we have a duty officer on duty all the time. And when a disaster like this strikes, we stand up a response management team that goes into operation 24 hours a day, around the clock, to be able to answer any questions and help us do the logistical part of this.
And the logistical part of this, well, that's the complicated part.
It's indeed the complicated part. But the most complicated part is probably coordination. But logistics is certainly a challenge.
Well, why don't we take those one at a time. In terms of logistics, you're trying to find out, A, what's needed, and B, where supplies may be, and how to get B to A.
Well, where supplies may be, we pre-position supplies around the globe, and we're able to pull out, for instance, for Asia, we take supplies out of our warehouse in Dubai. And we're part of USAID, and USAID, as well as American embassies, have offices in all of the countries we operate in. So we're able to get a sense of what the basic needs are and what's appropriate, and we know how emergencies develop and the kinds of basic things that you need to get in quickly. So we immediately mobilize, alert our warehouses, and begin to mobilize basic supplies like blankets and tents and plastic sheeting and water jugs, basic kinds of items that may not be available easily within country. But, of course, we try and purchase any items we can within the country because it not only is quicker and we don't have the shipping, but it helps the economy of the country, which is a very important thing in a disaster.
And you would find out about the availability of such things from the U.S. Embassy, in this case in Islamabad?
Yes. I mean, that's the advantage that we have as a U.S. response team, is that we're part of a larger family that's already in country and in most cases has been in those countries for over 50 years, for instance, in India and Pakistan. So they have a deep knowledge of the culture and what the norms and customs are in each country.
And those are obviously critical factors. If you bring the wrong kind of food or medicine, what's the point?
Well, it's not just what's the point, but always there's a very narrow logistical pipeline into most of these countries. So anything that's not absolutely needed becomes a liability because it clogs up the pipeline and then keeps more higher priority supplies from getting in as quickly.
Then there's the question of your team. Are they also, in effect, warehoused, standing by, ready to go, or did you have to fly people in from the United States?
We have our regional advisors in the region, and immediately the USAID missions and quite often the embassies become part of the team. We form a U.S. government team along with the embassy personnel, the USAID personnel, and if it's a large disaster, the U.S. military comes in, and we all form one U.S. government team.
And in this case, for example, the U.S. military was able to bring in, for example, the Pakistan specifically requested heavy lift helicopters, as it happened, some were available in Afghanistan next door.
That's right, and they were just able to ferry them over very quickly to start carrying heavy loads out to these remote areas that are inaccessible by road.
And then you get to the question of when you're flying materials, I assume you're flying the materials from Dubai to as close to the affected area as you can get.
That's correct. We're landing them in Islamabad, which took some damage itself, and then we're ferrying them by helicopter out to the remote regions. But there's also a staging area in Muzaffarabad, which is the capital of Kashmir, the Pakistan-controlled Kashmir. And there's a second staging area there where things are being moved on.
And prioritizing those flights is, I assume, somebody's job, what to pack in the first plane, the second plane, and therefore, and thereon?
As I said, yes, we talk with the missions about what supplies might be available in country. And as I said, we only try and bring in supplies that aren't locally available.
Mm-hmm.
And we immediately get those moving and are able to get those there in the first days after the disaster. So we can get the relief supplies out through our non-governmental organization and private voluntary organizations that are actually the implementing partners for USAID out in the field.
And then there's the other part that you talked about, equally if not more complicated and difficult, and that is coordination, not just with Pakistan, but with all of the other countries that are eager to send help.
Yes, as you can imagine, the governments are very busy trying to respond to the disaster itself, and the coordination is a job on top of that, but a very, very important job. And we try and help as much as possible by helping to support the coordination effort and working with the rest of the international community, the bilateral donors and the multilateral donors. And usually under the UN organization, there's a coordination group that are set up. So we try and make sure that we're coordinating with them and any other main bilateral players and make sure that everybody's getting their information into a central database so we all understand what's coming in and what's needed. Because as I said, anything that's not absolutely needed becomes a liability in this situation.
I'm not sure politics is necessarily the right word, but pride get involved in these kinds of, we feel it's really important that our tents get there?
There is some of that, but not as much as you might expect. I think that everybody in these kinds of situations realizes that we need to coordinate, and disasters have an effect on people and will make them cooperate in ways that they never would have cooperated with in other circumstances. So everybody is really trying to do their best, and usually disasters mean that people put their pride aside.
As you look at this earthquake now, you're just there a little while now. What are your concerns? What are your biggest worries as we speak right now?
Well, once again, it's the remoteness of the area. This terrain is very much like the terrain in Nepal. It's very, very steep mountains. It's part of the Himalaya chain. They're the steepest, youngest mountains in the world. A lot of these communities are in remote valleys that are very difficult to access. The roads have been washed out. And as you mentioned in the introduction, the weather's turning bad. We had heavy rain and hail yesterday, which shut down operations in the afternoon. And we have a lot of the buildings are unstable. Hospitals have fallen down, so people are being treated out in the open. So trying to get shelter out is a major movement and a priority of the Pakistan government right now.
And obviously this is a critical area because the weather, given the season, is going to do nothing but get worse.
Absolutely. It's going to get colder and colder. So we have to get shelter and blankets and supplies out to people as quickly as possible.
Now, you, as I also mentioned, have been involved in earlier disasters, among them the Gujarat earthquake in India. Are there a lot of similarities?
Well, you know, for those of us who do this for a living and go to one disaster after another, you can discern patterns and you understand sort of what the primary, secondary, and tertiary needs are going to be. But when you're usually working with the countries, they're usually places that haven't had that experience before. They're often suffering this for the first time in a very long period of time, and they may have lost the memory about how they responded to the last one. So we try and support the government by helping to bring the international experience and the experience that's been built up over the years with responding to disasters and how you can improve coordination and logistical flows,
mm-hmm.
these
but,
kinds of things.
But do you encounter situations with some governments where they say we really should press for one particular part of aid, and you say, well, you might be better advised to really push tents right now?
Well, you know, most governments are pretty open to the international community after a disaster has happened, and they very quickly realize that the more input you can get, the more good thinking you can get, the better you're going to respond. So they may initially start out in a sort of closed fashion, but very quickly they see that it's a very, very complex issue, and they're usually very open to working with the international community in a response.
Bill Berger, thank you for your time this evening, and I think everybody can join in wishing you the best of luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Bill Berger is the leader of the U.S. government's Disaster Assistance Response Team, the DART team in Pakistan, and was kind enough to join us by phone from his hotel in Islamabad. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue to talk about international disaster relief with the head of Doctors Without Borders and see how they make their decisions. Join us, 800-989-8255, email totn@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing international relief efforts today, how they're organized, who decide what goes where, and who pays for it. If you have questions about the organization of such efforts, if you've been involved in them yourself, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières, is often one of the very first international organizations on the scene after disaster occurs. Doctors and nurses arrive within just a few hours' notice to help stabilize survivors and assess the scope of the emergency. Joining us now is Tone Kuna, the emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders. He's on the phone from his home in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Good evening to you, sir.
Good evening.
How did you learn about the Pakistani earthquake, and what were the first steps you took?
From the news, from the media. We heard it on the radio, and we immediately called all the people on standby, on call, and we came to the office on Saturday morning, and we started organizing all relief efforts.
And how do you begin to organize such a thing? You must have to try to assess the scale of the disaster.
Yes, ideally you would like to have a full picture of what is happening, but the information is very limited. So what we do first of all is establishing an assessment team, dispatching immediately to the area. But from experience, we can also say that we have learned that the needs are in this kind of situations with these natural disasters are pretty similar. So we have enough experience to start working on the required goods, such as medical supplies and non-food items, food items. And we also establishing a team together.
And who did you decide to send?
Well, we started working on a team of medical doctors and nurses, as well as surgeons, water sanitation engineers, and also psychiatrists to provide mental health, and of course coordinators to coordinate all these people and these activities.
And how many plane loads are we talking about?
Well, over the weekend we managed to send two cargo planes, and tomorrow morning another one will go, and in the next coming 2-3 days we expect another 2-3 cargo planes with relief goods.
And that's obviously a lot of material. How do you decide how much to spend on an operation like this?
Well, as I said, from experience, we know what the immediate needs are. If part of villages or whole villages are have collapsed and houses have collapsed, we know that people need shelter, they need food, they need blankets, they need water containers, they need water, but also medical care, of course. So all very basic needs what people have need to survive.
If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 800-989-8255 or send us email totn@npr.org. Here's Spencer. Spencer on the line from Durham, North Carolina.
Hi.
Hi, Spencer. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've done some work with the Carolina Medical Mission out of Raleigh, North Carolina. It wasn't emergency work, but we worked in the Philippines. And one of the main challenges we've had is getting essential supplies and medicines in through the bureaucracy within the government in the country that we're going to, which was the Philippines. I wanted to see if that was a problem at all in Pakistan.
Tone Kuna, is government bureaucracy an obstacle to MSF?
No, not at all. We got full cooperation from the Pakistani authorities, and we managed to get all the required drugs in over the weekend.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Spencer. Do you coordinate with other agencies to make sure that you're not duplicating efforts?
Yes, of course. We work with the United Nations agencies and also with other agencies on the ground. Over the weekend, when our teams arrived, there was nobody else, so there was not much to coordinate. But slowly, more agencies coming in, and relief is getting up to speed. And of course, we have to join a coordination forum where we make sure that we don't duplicate and we don't walk in each other's feet.
And is this divvied up in terms of regions? We'll take the northwest part, you take the northeast part, or how does that work?
Yes, often it's based on geographical divisions, but also sometimes on specialities of agencies. Some agencies are much better or specialized in water and sanitation activities. Others are better in food distributions. Others are better or specialized in medical relief. So sometimes agencies have to work together in a similar area.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Osman. Osman calling us from South Bend, Indiana.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a question, how you guys make sure that all that aid end up in the right hands and not, because I know there's a history back in Afghan war, then that time the aid people used to sell it on the local stores and make money out of that. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
What we always do, we always make sure, is that our staff is present during any distribution or in the clinic. So we're not distributing through the authorities, or do we distribute or dump the drugs in a clinic and then move on to the next. We always make sure we guarantee quality. Our doctors and nurses are with the national doctors who are working in the clinics. We make sure that quality is provided. And when there's a distribution of food items or non-food items, we always have expatriates present to make sure that the relief is reaching the people who need it.
There are also some political sensibilities that are sometimes involved, and I'm not sure that this is involved in this particular operation, but sometimes working with the government, if you do, can be seen as difficult for some of the people involved if there's been a political instability in the region, or working with outside governments, in this case maybe the U.S., that might cause problems. Do you work with the governments involved?
In Pakistan, of course, we do work with the ideally, we would like to work with the authorities who are in charge of that area. In Pakistan, these are the Pakistani authorities and the Pakistani military, and we have to work together with them. Now, if they are in a conflict, however, then we will refrain from doing so, and then we want to be completely independent and not have anything to do with any worrying faction.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, this is obviously a natural disaster. Things occur suddenly. The need is immediate. How does the organization for this kind of an operation differ from a situation of, for example, a long-running civil war?
Well, it's very different because the natural disaster like the tsunami or the earthquake or a mudslide is a very sudden event with very high impact among many people, often hundreds, thousands of people. This long term, long-lasting conflicts, like in Sudan or Congo, for instance, in Darfur, where we have been now for over 1.5 years, this is a very different project, where we always stay for a longer period of time, and we also face very different problems in this area, especially regarding security. In Pakistan at the moment, there is not so much of a security issues, but when you compare that with Darfur, for instance, we have to have a very different security management and tools in place to make sure that our national staff and our expatriate staff are safeguarded.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Adwa, am I pronouncing that correctly, in Franklin, Virginia?
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
He said that he was a doctor, and I wanted to know that, I mean, the doctors go in there and give medical care and all the things. What do the public health scientists do?
I'm sorry, that last phrase again, Adwa?
Pardon?
I didn't hear the last part of your question.
What do the public health scientists do? What role do they play during the disaster?
The role of public health officials and public health scientists, yes.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I don't really understand the question. Your question is, what is the role of public health experts?
What do they do during disaster time?
And the local public health officials, I think, is what she's asking about as well.
All right. Well, we work very closely with the local health officials, of course. When you are in a situation like earthquake in Pakistan, public health risks are tremendous. At the moment, people lack clean water, so there's a risk of diarrheal diseases. There is a lot of cold in the night, so you have also a lot of infection, chest infections, and we have to monitor the situation very closely and make sure that whenever there's an epidemic to break out, that we control that, and that's often done together with the authorities of the Minister of Health in Pakistan, in this case.
Okay, thank you for taking my question.
And thank you for the phone call, Adwa. Let me ask you a question. You were talking about part of the team that you've sent out there involves a psychiatrist to deal with the mental health problems. What about your teams? They must be under an enormous stress.
Well, yes, the teams are now settled in a place called Muzaffarabad, and there's absolutely nothing. So they sleep in the open air. They have... We have given them warm sleeping bags and a lot of spaghetti and cookies, and they have to find a way, of course. Now, they're all together. They are 20 expats together, so I'm sure they have also lots of fun. But it's hard for them, not only the living conditions, as it is cold in the night, but also the stress they experience during the work and the suffering they see from the people. So it's not easy for these people who are on the front lines, yeah.
And are they volunteers for the most part?
Yeah, all of them are volunteers, and of course they get some incentives, but they do that pure from a humanitarian impulse.
Let's talk now with another caller, Arjun, calling from Peru, Indiana.
Hi, are you there?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Sorry, I was wondering, how are you guys dealing with the aftershocks that's happening after the earthquake, in trying to get the relief efforts to the people that need them?
This has been causing a lot of problems in terms of delivering supplies, at least from what we've read here. Is that your experience, Tone Kuna?
Yeah, well, the aftershocks were not so much a problem. It was actually funny, when I was talking with our coordinator on the ground on Sunday morning, he said, "Hang on," and then he started running out of the house because there was an aftershock. So it was very much alive still. But the problem of the aftershocks is not so much a problem for us to provide relief. The earthquake itself has been much more of a problem. Not only that, houses and buildings have collapsed, but also a lot of bridges and a lot of roads have fallen into the ravines. So a lot of villages in Pakistan are not accessible anymore. So we can't reach them by vehicles. And therefore, we have now managed to secure a helicopter from a different country, from a company. So we are completely independent from other military and Pakistani authorities flying around in this area, and we can reach all the villages we would like to get to.
Arjun, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
And one final question. Who pays for this?
We have our operations at this moment are funded by all public funds from our own society, people who make donations in the U.S., in England, in Holland, in Germany, in whole Europe. And from that money, we generate this project.
Tone Kuna, thank you. And again, I think on behalf of everybody, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Tone Kuna is the emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders, and he joined us on the phone from his home in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. We're talking about the Organization of Disaster Relief. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Relief supplies and millions of dollars are flowing into Pakistan from all over the world, but as with any major disaster, there are logistical constraints, limited numbers of runways, roads, helicopters, and storage facilities. Coordination is critical. The United Nations often takes a leading role in doing that. Eric Schwartz is deputy in the office of the Special Envoy for Tsunami Recovery at the United Nations. He's also the former senior director for multilateral and humanitarian affairs at the National Security Council, and he joins us by phone from his office in New York, and it's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you, Neil.
Walk us through, what's the first thing the United Nations does in response to a disaster? Which branch plays the coordinating role?
Well, the coordination on humanitarian response is undertaken by the Office of the Coordinator for Humanitarian Affairs, and the Undersecretary is Jan Egeland. This office over the past several years has really strengthened its role in coordination. This has been an issue which really has bedeviled the UN system and the international community for decades. And the OCHA, as it's known, has really started to play a much more significant role. And what OCHA does is not all that different than what USAID does, which is initially they send out the functional equivalent of DART, or disaster assistance response teams, which is the U.S. government term.
Mm-hmm.
The U.N. calls them UNDAC teams, disaster assessment coordination teams, to try to assess just how bad the situation is. The U.N. often has agencies, the U.N.-affiliated agencies, who are on the ground, and that gives the institution a certain advantage. In Pakistan, for example, a number of agencies have supplies and are able to bring them to bear more quickly than if they had to transport them from much further distances. And then after these assessments come in, the UN often, OCHA often coordinates what's called a flash appeal. And increasingly, these appeals are not only appeals for funds from UN-related agencies, but from other institutions as well, including, in the Pakistan case, from the non-governmental community, which plays a very important role in disaster assistance response.
Mm-hmm.
The flash appeal for Pakistan, I believe, is, my area is tsunami, but I believe in the Pakistan case it's been $272 million. And on the ground, in crises like this, the UN also puts together coordination teams to help manage the flow, designating lead agencies, humanitarian agencies that have particular expertise, so they take the lead in responding to particular needs.
I was wondering how this changes over time. I mean, the tsunami, I'm not sure this is the right phraseology. It sounds pretty cold, but it's a much more mature disaster.
Well, that's a very good question. And I think one of the realities that we're confronting is that the international system, we never do well enough. And more people die than should, and more people suffer than should. And that's the caveat that you have to begin with. But the fact of the matter is that the international community and member states of the United Nations really have a better developed response capability with respect to humanitarian assistance. That is the urgent relief that's required in the first several weeks and maybe even months after a disaster. We do better in that respect than we do in the transition from relief to longer-term reconstruction and development. And that's where the critical challenge lies. And in fact, in the tsunami case, that's precisely where we are. And moving from life-saving humanitarian assistance to the recovery process, moving from transitional shelter to permanent homes, to rebuilding communities, to getting people back to work, which is still recovery, not really sort of traditional development, but it's much more than humanitarian assistance. And frankly, that is why, one of the reasons why the Secretary General asked former President Clinton to serve as Special Envoy for Tsunami Recovery, for the purpose of sustaining the interest of the international community after CNN leaves, after the television cameras are gone, but while people are still suffering and in need. The other point I should make...
Eric Schwartz, I'm afraid we're out of time, but we have to thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Eric Schwartz at the United Nations. We'll be back with more after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about the organization of international relief efforts. Our guest is Eric Schwartz. He's Deputy Special Envoy at the Office of Tsunami Recovery at the United Nations. And Eric, before the break, you were talking about the intermediate period after the search and rescue operations are over, after the CNN cameras leave, before traditional development efforts get underway, and the importance of that sort of intermediate period.
Yeah, it's absolutely critical, and I'll be honest and say that, you know, while the international system has done very well or reasonably well in enhancing, improving how we coordinate relief and humanitarian assistance in the immediate aftermath, we haven't done as well in this transition period, and it's an area that where our office and others are trying to look at ways to improve coordination, because, you know, people have to move from transitional shelters to permanent homes. They have to get their livelihoods back together. There are all kinds of planning challenges for national governments, and that really is where we are now in the tsunami recovery case. But the other point I wanted to make was that in spite of this transition, we can't forget that urgent humanitarian needs don't go away. 9 months after the tsunami hit, there are still many thousands of people in Indonesia who are still living in completely unacceptable conditions, and that's something that we have to continue to work very hard to fix. So humanitarian issues don't go away during the recovery process, but recovery and humanitarian assistance have to go forward hand in hand.
So it's not just a phase one to phase two, but phase one and phase two.
That's exactly right.
Let me ask you about this. You say we don't get it quite right. Is that a result of bureaucratic inertia? Is that a result of flagging attention? Is it a result of underfunding? Is it a result of politics?
I don't think there are any nefarious reasons for this. I think it's a function of a number of factors. We do better on humanitarian assistance because, frankly, when people are in life or death situations, the attention of the international community is focused much more acutely. Also, the requirements, in a certain way, your requirements when you're dealing with life-saving relief are relatively speaking more straightforward. People need to be protected against communicable diseases. They need to get food. They need to get shelter. They need to get clothing in some cases. But when you're talking about recovery towards development, the requirements become much more complicated. Where do you, in the case of tsunami, for example, you're rebuilding permanent homes. Well, where do you rebuild permanent homes when some of the land on which people were living no longer exists? The coordination challenge is much greater because it involves a much greater involvement of national governments, a much broader proliferation of UN agencies that are involved. It's just a bigger challenge, and one that has not gotten the same degree of attention. But the system is, you know, but the international community, I think, is doing better than it's done in the past. The UN, the United Nations system tries to pull together organizations that are involved in the recovery effort. Our office, the Office of the Special Envoy, was created largely to perform that objective. And in the tsunami case, I think we have some progress to report. For example, we're moving forward on a unified system of financial tracking and accountability in each of the tsunami-affected countries called the Development Assistance Database. This is unique, or not unique, it was drawn from the experience in Afghanistan, but it's unique given the magnitude of this challenge, the involvement of non-governmental organizations, the involvement of UN agencies, the involvement of non-UN agencies. Putting together a single coherent financial tracking system for each country that was affected, that's progress. There are other examples of progress on coordination, but more needs to be done.
Eric Schwartz, thanks very much. Eric Schwartz is Deputy Special Envoy in the Office of the Special Envoy for Tsunami Recovery at the UN, and he was kind enough to join us today by phone from his office in New York.